You are about to hear the truth about Palestinian rights, Israeli rights, straight from Jerusalem, from the mouth of a Messianic Jewish lawyer.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, things continue to boil in Ferguson, Missouri, and I'm hoping to write an article tonight on five things that we can learn from what is happening in Ferguson, Missouri. That's not going to be my focus today. I talked about that second hour yesterday, but it's Wednesday, and even though it's Wednesday, not Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, we're going to be going to Jerusalem today. Oh, this is red hot news. Yet another violation of a ceasefire. Is it the 11th such violation? Hamas raining down rockets on Israel. I know that some will not be happy unless Jews are killed. In other words, well, Israel can't fight back. It's not fair. They have this Iron Dome, and Hamas's weaponry is not that sophisticated. So, I mean, you have to have more Jewish casualties to make it kind of equal. Yeah, it's shameful thinking, but it is thinking that's out there. 60 rockets fired in less than 11 hours. I put a graphic up on our Facebook page on Ask Dr. Brown on Facebook, Ask Dr. Brown on Facebook. But we're going to go to Jerusalem, and we are going to speak directly with Caleb Myers, Caleb as in Caleb and Joshua. Caleb is the founder of the Jerusalem Institute of Justice, which is a human rights group in Israel. He finished a degree at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, joined the Israeli Bar Association as a lawyer, and he stands up for the rights of Messianic Jews in Israel. He's been on the front lines of that. He is standing for truth about Israel, the truth about the security barrier, the truth about alleged war crimes, genocide charges like that. He also cares very much about Palestinian rights, and he is convinced that the greatest enemy to the well-being of the Palestinians is leadership as provided by groups like Hamas. So we're going to be speaking with Caleb, and I'm also going to give him an opportunity to respond to comments made by Palestinian Christian leader Alex Awad. I had Reverend Awad on the air with me a couple of weeks back, and I told him to speak freely as a Palestinian Christian. I told him not to worry about offending me or offending the listening audience. He knows I differ with many things he had to say scripturally and historically. We are fellow believers in Jesus, and that's what unites us. And we find forgiveness in him, and we look to the cross as the solution to all human problems. At the same time, Reverend Awad was fully aware that I differed with things he was saying, but I made clear I was not there to debate him, but to give him a platform to share his perspective. Here and there, I explained why I differed and where, but otherwise, let him speak. I have not yet returned to those comments, but I want to give Caleb Myers an opportunity to respond to them. I am holding in my hand, from a month ago, an article in BBC by Nick Hallett, or about BBC. The BBC has admitted that pictures of alleged Israeli airstrikes on Gaza and their aftermath may be inaccurate. Certainly there has been suffering. We don't minimize that. But many things are staged. Many things are misleading. And Hamas has recently expelled journalists who have reported the truth. So, we come back right after the break. We are going straight to Jerusalem with Caleb Myers, head of the founder and leader of the Jerusalem Institute of Justice. And we're going to tell the truth. You're going to hear the truth. Some of you are going to like what you hear. Some of you are not going to like what you hear. But I assure you, we're going to be as accurate as we know how. Prepare to have your eyes opened. We'll be right back.
The world. fire we
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to the Line of Fire broadcast. It is Wednesday, not Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, but we are going to Jerusalem, and I am joined by my guest, Caleb Myers, who is the founder of the Jerusalem Institute for Justice, lived in Israel since 1992. Caleb, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you. It's good to be with you, Dr. Brown.
What is it that brought you over to Israel in the first place?
You know, my father is Jewish, and we love Israel, and we wanted to come over here and support the nation, and I immigrated when I was 18 years old, and served in the Israeli Defense Forces like everyone has to. There's mandatory military service for all men for 3 years and women for 2 years, and actually we stay in reserve duty until the age of 40, but so I served in the Israeli Army, and then I married a wonderful Israeli lady and settled down here.
You launched the Jerusalem Institute for Justice. What was the purpose in launching that?
You know, our main goals in the Jerusalem Institute of Justice have been to protect freedom of religion in Israel. Israel, you know, our founding fathers defined the state as a Jewish and democratic state. Sometimes there can be a tension between being a Jewish state and a democratic state. You know, although I believe that that's an attainable reality, we just need to protect the rights of minorities within our system. By minorities, I'm referring to Christians, and particularly Messianic Jews. These are a lot of the types of cases that we've handled in the Jerusalem Institute of Justice. Trying to strengthen the Israeli democracy and create more freedom of religion within our society. We've also taken on other really big projects. We have a big project which in its earlier years was fighting human trafficking in Israel. And now that problem has been curbed to a great extent, we're concentrating our efforts on advancing anti-prostitution legislation. We have another project which represents former Haredi or ultra-religious Jews who have chosen a more secular lifestyle and at the juncture when they turn 18, they've chosen to serve in the Israeli military, which most ultra-religious don't do. And because of that, they've been kicked out of their families and basically homeless. And so we refer to them as lone soldiers, and we try to be a family, so to speak, for lone soldiers and feed them over the weekend in Jerusalem here at a hotel that's owned by friends of mine and care for their basic needs, give them legal representation if they have problems, and so on and so forth. So the Jerusalem Institute of Justice is really an organization which tries to be a voice for those without a voice within Israeli society.
All right. From what you're saying, it's evident that you do not just give carte blanche support to everything the Israeli government and Israeli people do, that as a loyal citizen, that you sometimes take issue with your country. I would assume that also means that if you feel there's injustice towards the Palestinians, you care about that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, over the last 10 years, my organization has successfully handled over 600 legal cases challenging the Israeli government on policies. And that's including 22 Supreme Court victories in which we petitioned against Israeli government policy. So definitely we don't agree with everything Israel does. I will say that I feel very fortunate that Israel is a democracy with proper functioning separation of powers, that we do have a court that we can go to that upholds the rule of law. And for that reason, we've been victorious in the overwhelming majority of the cases we've taken to court. And yes, I would love to see that same justice applied to Palestinians as well, regardless of what religion they belong to. I think that all people are created in God's image and therefore have certain unalienable rights. And one thing that my organization does is that we carefully research and report on human rights abuses in the Palestinian Authority. These are abuses by the Palestinian Authority, the Hamas, and the nation and the Arab nations surrounding Israel towards Palestinians. Many people don't know this. It's kind of counterintuitive because a lot of the news is coming out of Israel. But Israel is actually not the primary abuser of Palestinian human rights, by far. And what we've seen is every area that's been given over to more Palestinian autonomy, we've seen a direct correlation of and deterioration of Palestinian human rights. And so we document these very carefully and present some of our reports before decision makers and funders of the Palestinian Authority, mostly in the international community, the European Union. We've also taken these things to many university campuses and done symposiums. We say, yeah, let's discuss Palestinian human rights and put some facts on the table that most people aren't used to hearing.
All right. What about the recent so-called unity government reconciliation between Hamas and Palestinian Authority, Fatah? What's the history of these two groups? Have they been friendly in the past?
Absolutely not. There's been, in fact, you're seeing right now Hamas wreak havoc in Gaza. But if we go back to 2005 and or 2007 is when they forcefully took over the Gaza Strip. Hamas, in 2007, took PLO representatives of the Palestinian Authority up to rooftops, shot them in the knees, and threw them off 13-story buildings. They made a very clear statement that, the PLO is no longer in power. And they did this by very violent means. Those types of blood feuds don't go away easily in the Middle East. And the PLO, most of the violence in the West Bank and Hamas, and I'm talking about arbitrary arrests, tortures, public executions, are done from the Hamas towards PLO members in the Gaza Strip and from the PLO towards Hamas members in the West Bank. They have a very violent relationship. This unity government that was created recently, if you really look at what they did, they didn't put any influential leaders in this government. They created a council of people who they called technocrats. So these are basically people at the administrative level in both of their governments who don't have any power whatsoever. And they said, let's put them together and call this sort of council of people national unity government, although they don't really have a lot of decision-making power. And the reason that they did this is because they're trying to present a facade of unity to the world when under the surface that unity really doesn't exist. And so it's more of a negotiation tactic towards Israel, I think, because by choosing the Hamas rather than staying at the negotiation table with Israel, they made a very clear statement that they're really turning their back on the peace process. Just in case your listeners aren't aware, the primary difference between Hamas and PLO, the PLO throughout the years has made it very clear that their intent is to destroy the state of Israel as a Jewish state. In other words, they don't want Jewish sovereignty anywhere in the Middle East, and they're going to fight as hard as they can against it. Hamas, in their founding documents, doesn't just call for the destruction of the Jewish state, but it calls for the annihilation of Jews. And so in its very founding documents, it quotes pretty radical scriptures from the Quran that say, on the last days, every rock and tree will cry out, I have a Jew behind me, come and slay him. And this type of language. For this reason, they've been recognized as a terrorist organization by the United States, Canada, the European Union, Jordan, Egypt, Israel, Japan. And so, by PLO saying, we're going to bring these people into government, what they're basically saying is, we're creating at least on the surface, a pact with an entity that that very clearly states its intentions to annihilate the Jews.
Yeah, and this is the alleged peace partner. We've got a break coming up. When we come back, I want to throw out to you and get a brief response to each thing, some of the major talking points, war crimes with Israel, genocide, apartheid wall, some of the claims from Palestinian Christians, the settlement policy. And one thing that's clear, President Carter said that Israel missed its moment to deal with Hamas as a legitimate partner. And when they formed the unity government with Palestinian Authority, that they were thereby affirming their recognition of the Jewish state. Absolute nonsense, friends. Absolute nonsense. Hamas has never done that, and it would be a violation of who they are if they did. We'll be right back with Caleb Myers, founder of the Jerusalem Institute of Justice.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
They had four rounds of talks and many hours of indirect negotiations, but once again, the Israelis and the Palestinians have failed to reach an agreement, and this time, they also failed to extend the all-important ceasefire, so in many ways, they've gone backwards, and now we enter a very dangerous period of uncertainty where once again, the stage is set for more fighting and more violence.
They. So it's Israel and Hamas equally guilty. I'm looking at a CNN news report. Strikes, counterstrikes resume between Israel and Hamas after talks fail. No. Hamas breaks yet another ceasefire, and much of the world misreports it. A man who's reporting it accurately, you may have seen him on CNN or other news outlets, Caleb Myers, the founder of the Jerusalem Institute of Justice. Go to jij.org.il to find out more. Caleb, is it frustrating to see so much misinformation put forth from the media and actually believed?
Yeah, it's very frustrating for me as an Israeli and somebody who sees the carnage that Hamas is creating, not only for Israel, but more for the Palestinians in Gaza than anywhere else. I mean, Hamas is the absolutely worst thing that ever happened to Gaza. And you're right to say that it's not they. It's a ceasefire today can be accurately defined by Israel ceasing and Hamas continuing to fire. That's what's happened in the last seven ceasefires.
And do you mind if I quote you on that? That'll go well on social media. We'll reduce that
to
a soundbite. All right. Okay. Let me throw out some accusations to you. And you can respond briefly, and we can dig more if we need to, but I want to get to as many as we can. Israel is guilty of committing genocide against the Palestinians in Gaza.
You know, that's absolutely inaccurate. The opposite is quite true. Israel, no army in the world, on the face of the earth, takes more precautions to save innocent lives than Israel in taking care of this military conflict and trying to debilitate Hamas. That includes hundreds of thousands of phone calls to Palestinians warning them that Israel is going to be bombing a certain area, asking them to leave their premises, dropping hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of leaflets into certain areas so people can flee. But it's very tricky because Hamas is doing the exact opposite. Hamas is systematically creating two war crimes. Number one, it's targeting primarily Israeli civilian targets. So every man, woman, and child within Israel is a legitimate military target by Hamas. And number two, it's firing its rockets from civilian areas and using men, women, and children as human shields. It's firing from clinics and hospitals and mosques and churches and schools. All this has been documented very carefully. I want to say that I think it actually goes beyond using them as human shields, because they're not really shielding anything. They're not preventing people from dying or buildings from being destroyed. I think Hamas is using people as human sacrifices. They're sacrificing babies so that their pictures can be sent around the world in order to create more hatred towards Israel and to raise more funds for the evil intense.
What about the fact that the whole world saw Israel blowing up or killing four Palestinian boys just playing soccer near the beach? Israel targeted them and killed them. How can you make the claims that Israel is protecting civilians?
You know, it's astounding to me that in the midst of this conflict, where Hamas is shooting missiles next to these civilian areas, while my children are running to the bomb shelter, to take cover from incoming missiles, the Palestinian children are playing on the beach next to Hamas militants. I mean, yeah, and Hamas is purposely warning people not to run away from these areas, to stay in their houses, to stay out on the beach, because if they're killed, then they're going to be martyrs, and and at the end of the day, this will delegitimize Israel and help the Palestinian cause. So it's all very, very cynical. Having said that, I mean, the loss of every life is absolutely a tragedy. It's a horrific tragedy, and having served in the Israeli army, I can tell you that if the Israeli officers knew that there were children playing down the beach, they never would have fired this missile that killed them. So there's no intentional killing of civilians happening here on Israel.
But look, Gaza is just an open-air prison that Israel has blockaded. What else can the people possibly do other than fight?
Before they started firing missiles, Israel in 2005 withdrew everybody, all of the Jewish residents from the Gaza Strip in hopes of having peace. And at that time, there wasn't this huge blockade there's more free travel of people in and out of the Gaza Strip. But starting in 2005 until today, Hamas has fired over 20,000 missiles. And also, it tried to import by ship that Israel has caught coming in from Iran, boats carrying 400,000 tons of ammunition, missiles, and rockets that are going to be fired at Israel. So Israel put a naval blockade in place to prevent Hamas from importing all these rockets that are going to be used against Israel. This is a completely legitimate and completely legal act under international law. Israel has never prevented, humanitarian aid, food, and basic commodities from entering the Gaza Strip. Even today, in the midst of the conflict, it allows truckloads of aid every day to go across the borders and meet the basic needs of the Palestinian people. Every nation has the right to defend itself, and Israel has a very, very difficult neighbor over there. It's the only government in the world that's also a terrorist organization, and it's really difficult to do that.
Just before I throw out some more of these challenges that you hear endlessly and that tragically become talking points based on complete falsehood, right now, just really quick, because we've got a break coming up, the average Israeli, how do they look at the American government's involvement right now? Are they looking at it as helpful or harmful?
I think that there is some disappointment regarding the United States' involvement that led up to this conflict. Certainly, John Kerry saying we're gonna push the parties to negotiate hard and come out with a peace agreement within 9 months. Setting an impossible date or goal like that, to resolve a conflict that's been taking place for several thousand years, just puts pressure on the parties and forces them into the corner, so to speak. And I think that much of this current conflict could have been avoided if that wasn't the case. We all want and hope for peace. I'm speaking as a majority of the Israelis here, but I think it's going to take some time for that to happen.
Got it. All right, friends, we will be right back. If you appreciate the work that we're doing, become a torchbearer. Join us as a monthly supporter. Go to Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. Click on Donate. Let's partner together to make a difference.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to the Line of Fire. It is Wednesday, but we're doing a thoroughly Jewish topic today. Speaking with Caleb Myers, he is the founder of the Jerusalem Institute of Justice, a unique and very important organization in Israel. I encourage you to find out what they're doing, get involved. Go to jij.org.il. Caleb, thanks so much for taking time out of your schedule to join us on the broadcast. You know, I remember the first time we sat down at a meal together, we exchanged Jewish jokes. Do you remember that?
Yes.
And in fact, there was a joke you told me that had a totally unexpected punchline that I loved, but I forgot. So one day we're going to have to see if we can figure out what that was. But I think our conversation started with, so have you heard this one? There's always humor in the midst of the pressure and intensity, and Israeli life on the one hand has to go on like normal, but it's not so normal when you have to constantly run to bomb shelters. This is a reality. Caleb, I want to, in a moment, play some clips for you from a guest I had on the air a couple of weeks ago. Reverend Alex Awad is a respected Palestinian Christian leader, and I wanted him to have a platform to share his viewpoint so that my listening audience can understand there are other viewpoints out there, and I made it clear that I differed with much of what he was saying. So I want to give you an opportunity to respond, but let's just throw out a few more of these inflammatory talking points that much of the world believes. Israel built an apartheid wall. How do you respond to that?
First of all, if you drive through Israel, you won't see a wall. We do have a security fence. 97% of the fence is a chain link fence. 3% of it is made of concrete, and that's usually what the world sees, you know, in certain checkpoints and areas throughout Israel. Second of all, if it's an apartheid offense, which is created in order to have ethnic separation, it's extremely unsuccessful, since there are about 1.5 million Arabs living on the predominantly Jewish side of the fence and about 350,000 Jews living on the predominantly Arab side of the fence. There's also freedom of travel in and out through the fence. Every morning, at least 70,000 Palestinians come through security points in the fence to work in Israel, and then go back home in the evening. And actually, before the fence was created, there were about 75 checkpoints throughout the West Bank. And after they created the security fence, the vast majority of those checkpoints were taken down so that Palestinians aren't stopped and checked, you know, three or four times on the way back and forth to work. But they only have one line to stand in order to get to work. And so it actually, in some ways, created less inconveniences for Palestinians in the land.
Yeah, and the bottom line was it was built to keep murderers out. You've got a great video on it. In fact, we've linked to it. But what's happened to the murder rate of terrorists coming in and murdering Israelis since the security barrier was put up?
In 2002, when the government made the decision to build the security fence, there were over 400 deaths by Palestinian terrorism. These are people infiltrating Israel from the West Bank, murdering Israelis, and then going back to where they came from. That's more than one a day. And life was just terrible, Michael. I remember those years, and I remember getting on buses in Jerusalem and not knowing if I was going to be on the next bus to explode. And you know, and we lost a lot of innocent men. And so the government built this security fence. When it was completed in 2009, there were, I think, 8 Israelis that died that year through Palestinian terrorism. That means that the fence brought down death of innocent Israelis by terrorism by 99.9%. I, as an Israeli, think the fence is ugly. I think it's, you know, it's a monstrosity on our landscape, and I wish it didn't exist. But with the fence we live, without the fence we die, and that's the reason that it's there. It's not there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, a great, great video that just shows it as Caleb drives by the fence. All right, friends, we come back. Caleb Myers will respond to Reverend Alex Awad.
Send it, Lord. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
It's very difficult for me to look at the history and just say this is an act of God. Like, I cannot look at the Holocaust and say this is an act of God. I can't look at the 1948 Arab-Israeli War and say this is an act of God. I cannot look at 1967 and to say this is an act of God. All of these are atrocities, whether it is the Holocaust, 1948, 1967. So I would not blame God for these bloody atrocities and massacres.
That's the voice of Reverend Alex Awad on The Line of Fire. He's the Dean of Students, full-time instructor at Bethlehem Bible College, and a longtime pastor in Bethlehem. Caleb, how do you respond to those statements?
You know, I'm not going to get into a theological response with Dr. Awad, but I will say this, that I think the comparison between 1948, 1967, and the Holocaust is absolutely abhorrent. In the Holocaust, 6 million Jews were forcibly marched to their death by extermination in gas chambers in Nazi Germany. Comparing that to the suffering that Arabs suffered when Israel was attacked twice by five nations and armies four times their size, and in defense of their own existence, Palestinians fled, and Palestinian refugees were created in the Middle East, which is what Dr. Awad is referring to. There's no comparison, and I think just by referring to those two things is, you know, sometimes how questioning is this an act of God or not. It's just really abhorrent.
Yeah, abhorrent. I would use the word obscene with you 100%. Listen to what he says about Hamas. This is clip number 5, and playing a clip from Reverend Alex Awad, and Caleb Myers, the founder of the Jerusalem Institute of Justice, is giving his candid response. Clip number 5.
To a certain extent, Hamas is an Islamic militant group, and they have an ideology. And I certainly don't agree with their ideology, and I don't agree with their tactics. But Hamas did not come from nowhere. Hamas is the result of years and years of oppression of the Palestinian people.
Back to you, Caleb.
You know, Hamas is the direct ideological descendant of the Mufti of Jerusalem, Sheikh Hussein, who back in the day collaborated with Hitler and completely rejected the partition plan decided by the United Nations, which gave the Jews right to a large portion of the land of Israel to create a Jewish homeland. That's what Dr. Awad is referring to when he's referring to occupation. Since the UN decision to partition Israel in 1947 until today, the Palestinians and groups that eventually became Hamas completely rejected there ever being any Jewish sovereignty in Israel. But it's not connected to occupation. It's connected to their desire to annihilate Jews, because we withdrew from the Gaza Strip, for instance, in 2005. We're not there anymore. And to think that they fired 20,000 rockets because of occupation is absolutely ridiculous and historically incorrect.
Yeah, who cares about facts, though, when you have an ideology to drive? That's the frustrating thing, but ultimately we know that truth will triumph. Let's just hear from the heart of a Palestinian about the frustrations that they have, their dreams. Clip number 11.
We are not seeing any justice. We are seeing our land and our hopes and our aspiration for an independent Palestinian state evaporating. And as long as that happens, I don't think we can have genuine peace with the Israelis.
All right. I know you've been advocating a one-state solution, as is Caroline Glick. But what about the Palestinians? What about their hopes? Are those constantly being fueled by others, you know, next year in Jerusalem kind of thing, for Palestinians to be back in the land as opposed to living peacefully with the Israelis? What about the hopes of the Palestinians?
You know, I think that the anger towards Israel is misdirected by the Palestinian Christians. Israel is the only nation in the Middle East in which Christianity has grown in numbers and flourished. Everywhere else in the Middle East, it's persecuted. And every area that was given over to the responsibility of the Palestinian Authority, including Bethlehem, which is a traditionally Christian area, Christians have been persecuted. It's an official death penalty to convert from Islam to Christianity within the Palestinian Authority. Muslims can't sell land to Jews or Christians. Christians are a persecuted minority. And so I think for the human rights and civil rights of people like Mr. Awad, their hope should really be an Israeli administration taking over those areas and taking responsibility for them, rather than continuing to give more autonomy to the Palestinian Authority and creating a Palestinian state. I think that granting citizenship to the Arabs living throughout the West Bank is the greatest hope for their peace and security, rather than giving more recognition to the Palestinian Authority.
Now we know that the Palestinian refugees are really the only multi-generation refugees who have been encouraged to stay refugees. There are refugees in Palestinian refugees living in camps in Lebanon and Syria. You think, why is that? And obviously the Arab League resolution not to reincorporate the Palestinian Arabs into their own nations. There's a lot of money. I've got a few more Alex Awad clips I'd love for you to respond to, Caleb, but there's a lot of money that is sent to Palestinian refugees. As I understand, they get more per capita than any refugees anywhere in America. So where is all this money going? I mean, why is their lifestyle so below that of the Israelis if so much money is pouring in to their governments?
I mean, this is a huge question. Where did all the money go? If you take into account the money given to the Palestinian Authority, from the signing of the Oslo Accords until today, which is 20 years, it's well over more than 25 times per capita the amount of money given from the United States to Europe after World War II under the Marshall Plan for the complete reconstruction of Europe's economy. So in simple terms, with all the money given to the Palestinian over the last 20 years, we could have reconstructed Europe's economy 25 times. Where did all the money go? Why is the average Palestinian still living in abject poverty? We know that it didn't go to build modern infrastructure, industry, roads, and create jobs, etc., while the upper echelon of the Palestinian Authority has become extremely wealthy. Khaled Mashal, who's the leader of Hamas, was $2.6 billion. Mahmoud Abbas, leader of the Palestinian Authority, worth hundreds of millions of dollars. So these corrupt leaders have literally siphoned off money into their private bank accounts and used it to stockpile weapons and to build a quote-unquote police force, which is the most highly armed police force on the face of the earth, which is designed, of course, to be a threat to Israel, rather than actually helping the Palestinian people. Do you know that 600,000 tons of concrete went to build these terror tunnels underneath Gaza to carry out terrorist attacks in Israel? You know what could have done with the tens or hundreds of millions of dollars that it cost to build those tunnels to improve the life of Palestinians living in these areas? It's really a tragedy, first and foremost, for the Palestinian people.
Yeah, and let's just think for a moment, when Gaza was under Egyptian control, did anyone speak of the occupation? That's one question. And secondly, what was done for the people there? So the surrounding Arab nations have really not helped the Palestinians. True or false?
The surrounding Arab nations have made it very clear that they're not interested in helping the Palestinians. It goes all the way back to, you know, when the refugees were created in 1948. In the 1950s, the Arab League made an explicit decision that no state in the Middle East will grant the Palestinian citizenship. Now, Jordan is the only state that did deviate from that decision, granting some Palestinian citizenship. But today, they're revoking citizenship away from Palestinians, and they're preventing Palestinian refugees that are fleeing the violence in Syria now from settling in Jordan. They'll let anybody else into Jordan to settle in the refugee camps except for Palestinians. And the goal is to keep them in a perpetuated state of refugee so that there'll always be this threat looming over the head of Israel. You know, now the descendants of the 1948 refugees are about 5.5 million people. And so the idea is that all these people need to come back in flux of Israel so Jews become a minority and the Jewish democracy ceases to exist from the Middle East.
Yeah, that is the goal. All right, we've just got a couple more minutes with Caleb Mara. As we come back, Caleb, we'll talk about the settlements. Right now, news from Switzerland. Muslim protesters attempt to storm synagogue. Anti-Israel demonstrators wield placards saying every synagogue is an Israeli embassy. It's in Geneva, friends. Geneva.
Give us strength to always do what's right.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
And I believe Jewish settlements in the West Bank are the biggest obstacle to peace in the Middle East, and therefore they are evil. And if the Israelis want to make peace with the Palestinians and want to live in peace with the rest of the Arab world, they need to stop their project in the West Bank. I want to have peace. I want my children, grandchildren to have peace. But right now, with the current Israeli policy, it is impossible to see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Words of respected Palestinian Christian leader, Reverend Alex Awad, echoing what many others say, or they echo what he says, that the greatest obstacle to peace is the settlements, and if Israel was serious about peace, they would not keep expanding and taking the best land and living the way they live in the midst of their Palestinian neighbors. Caleb, I'm sure you've heard this often. Take your time to respond, please.
You know, for anyone after watching the events in Arab Spring to say that the settlements in the disputed territories in Israel are the greatest threat to peace in the Middle East, you have to be kidding. I mean, after Assad has slaughtered 150,000 of his own citizens in cold blood, after the Islamic State right now in Syria and Iraq is taking Christians, you know, decapitating them publicly, crucifying them, hanging them in public squares. After the violent protest that we saw in Egypt, these are Arabs protesting against evil dictatorial regimes and states throughout the Middle East. And I ask you to compare that to what's happening in the settlements in the West Bank, where I visit these places once in a while, and I go into grocery stores in these areas, and I see Palestinian Arabs and Jewish settlers walking through the aisles of the grocery store in peace and exchanging goods and money and living together. It's unbelievable how ridiculous that statement is if you compare it to all the other terrible things that are happening in these countries across the Middle East.
But isn't it inflammatory, just to take the Palestinian advocacy side for a moment, isn't it inflammatory for Israel to keep expanding into what would one day be Palestinian territory? Why are they doing that if they really want peace?
Yeah, well, what we need to understand is Israel isn't forcefully expropriating anybody's property here. A decision was made in the San Remo Conference in 1921 to create a Jewish homeland in the land of Israel. And the United Nations, acting upon that decision in 1947, passed a partition plan, which gave a certain amount of land to the Jews and a certain amount of land to Palestinians. Jewish leadership at that time agreed to this wholeheartedly. The Arab leadership said, over our dead bodies, and attacked Israel. Israel, in defending itself, ended up taking land again and defending itself from five nations that were attacking it in 1967. It took more land. If you look at the areas that it took in 1967, there was no Palestinian state in those areas. They were controlled by Jordan. And Jordan has relinquished any claim to those areas. So according to international law, if there is any entity that could claim the right to settle these areas, it would be Israel. If the Palestinians have a claim against Israel, it's not the fact that it's expanding its settlements. It's the fact that Israel hasn't granted citizenship yet to many of the Palestinians living in those areas. And I, as a human rights and civil rights activist, actually believe that Israel should extend citizenship to the Arabs living in the West Bank. And I think that would be a solution. I think it's something that would be the best for the Palestinians. But just to say that, you know, expanding these settlements is the biggest obstacle to peace in the Middle East, it's absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, Caleb, I appreciate you tirelessly speaking the truth about these issues. And I know your heart, too. I know that you would love to see the Palestinians as not just peaceful friends and neighbors, but fellow citizens enjoying life in greater Israel together. Obviously, there are a million other questions. And are they going to sing Hatikva as the national anthem and all these things? I know you thought of them, Caroline Glick. Others have thought of them. But saying we want one state is saying, hey, be our neighbors. If you don't try to kill us, we can really be good friends. I commend you also for the many other battles that you're fighting. And we'll do our best to get your information out to as many people as possible. We've just tweeted out and posted a graphic on Facebook with your great quote about ceasefire. So hopefully that will spread widely. And may the Lord's grace be yours, Caleb. Much appreciation.
Thank you very much.
All right, friends, go to Jerusalem Institute of Justice. That's jij.org.il. And just tweeted this out. Ceasefire between Israel and Hamas can be defined as Israel ceases, Hamas fires, quoting Caleb Myers, and we posted it as a graphic on Facebook just 5 minutes ago, and I think this might really take off because it is the truth expressed concisely. Friends, with all the hate mail that we get, with all the people who say I'm more dangerous than Hitler, and who were upset that I was not the Michael Brown who was killed in Missouri, a tragic loss of life there, whatever the circumstances. We get tons more words of encouragement. We get tons more people expressing appreciation, tons more people talking about the difference that we are making. And that so blesses us when we hear that. Someone just tweeted this out, keep fighting the God fight, Dr. Brown. God help America. From the UK, I would just like to say a massive thank you for being such a voice of clarity in these ever-darkening times of compromise and blurred lines. Myself and my husband appreciate your input more than words can say. On it goes. It's very, very encouraging as we're flooded with reports of people who've been helped through the ministry, through the radio broadcast. And remember, I'm fully aware, our team is fully aware, that many of you listening are not listening live on your local radio station. That's our number one priority, each of you listening live on local radio or on internet. Many of you are listening, though, later on in the day, my podcast. In fact, if I'm traveling and have to pre-record a broadcast and it's 1 hour that is then repeated in different parts of the nation, 1 hour in one city and then repeated in another city, those listening to my podcast will say, well, how come only 1 hour? I want to listen to two. That's very humbling. That means the world to us. That motivates our whole team to say, we want to serve even better. We want to be even more effective. And you can help us, literally. You can amplify my voice. If I'm speaking to 10 people, you can help me speak to 100. If I'm speaking to 100,000, you can help me speak to 1 million. If I'm speaking to 1 million, you can help me speak to 10 million. Your help literally amplifies my voice to speak to more and more people. So why not become a torchbearer, a monthly supporter? We'll send you as a thank you gift the Tree of Life version of the of the Bible, a messianic translation I was involved with. That'll be our thank you gift. It's a $30 value. And then every month we sow into you with a new message and materials. So stand with us. Put aside $1 a day or more, $30 or more per month. Become a torchbearer. Call 1-800-278-9978, 1-800-278-9978, or go to askdrbrown.org, click on donate. My bottom line today, it's frustrating to hear all the lies about Israel, but be encouraged. Truth will ultimately triumph over lies. Whoa, have you seen the latest Barna survey about pastors and leaders in America? It's an eye-opener.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, I have said for many years that the reason that America is so messed up is because the Church of America is so messed up. And the reason the Church of America is so messed up is that many leaders, Christian leaders, have been messed up. It makes sense, doesn't it? If we are the light of the world and there's something wrong with our light, it's going to affect the nation. If the leaders are responsible to lead, then our failings are going to hurt the rest of the body, and that's going to hurt the rest of the nation. A recent Barna poll really confirms that. I'm not here to point fingers. I'm not here to condemn. I'm not here to attack or accuse. I'm here to help. I'm here to help. And this hour will not be one where I'm going to be asking you to call and blast different TV preachers or blast different leaders. I want to be as constructive as I can. Michael Brown, welcome to The Line of Fire, 866-348-7884. Last hour, just had a terrific interview with Caleb Myers, who's the founder of the Jerusalem Institute of Justice. And you can listen to that interview later today. I know that many of you in different parts of America are just hearing me now. You're not getting the first hour, and many parts of America are getting the first hour and not the second hour, but everything is archived, in case you didn't know that. Everything is archived for free. Yeah, we could charge, but our goal is to try to reach as many as possible and to rely on the generosity of our listening audience to help us to do that. So I encourage you to get that first hour, even though it's Wednesday, it was a thoroughly Jewish Thursday topic. On Wednesday, talking about human rights, Palestinian rights, Israeli rights, separating fact from fiction. So later today, go to Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org, and click on latest audio to listen to that. Remember, you can subscribe by podcast. It's absolutely free. Our goal is to reach the maximum number of people with the truth. I would rather reach fewer people with the truth than more people with error. I would rather be accurate and reach fewer people than be inaccurate and reach more people. But why not be as accurate as possible and reach the maximum number of people? And that ties in directly with what I want to talk to you about. 866-34-TRUTH. And if you're a pastor leader, I'd love to hear from you and interact as well. I can speak freely as a leader, and I don't say, you guys, I say us, I say we. If you're a leader, if you've had to leave a denomination, if you've seen compromise in the ministry, if you've seen leaders departing from the front lines of cultural issues because they're too divisive and difficult, thereby hurting our nation and hurting the church, I'd love to hear from you. Perhaps, and you don't have to mention the denomination, but perhaps you've had to leave because of compromise. You are a leader, you are a pastor. I'd love to hear from you, because that won't be pointing fingers as much as saying we have a big problem. Before I get into that, though, I don't know if it's the first time on The Line of Fire I've done this, but certainly the first time that we're actually going to video my comments and put them on YouTube. I'm going to respond to Professor Richard Dawkins. This is a separate subject from what I'm going to be getting into the rest of the broadcast. Again, the number to call to weigh in on this conversation about compromised leadership hurting the nation, compromised Christian leadership hurting the whole nation, 866-34-TRUTH. When we come back, I want to share something with you that Richard Dawkins recently said that to me is utterly absurd, and I want to respond to it here in The Line of Fire. We will be right back.
Change the world.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. In a little while, we're going to be talking about why pastors and leaders sometimes avoid controversial issues, and according to a Barner survey, some very disturbing information about that. Before I do it, I'm going to change subjects. I think this is the first time that I've done this, recorded a video and spoken directly to Professor Richard Dawkins. But this quote came my way, and I thought it really deserves a response. Professor Dawkins has alleged that, quote, nice Christians, nice Muslims, might actually be making the world, quote, safe for extremists. So on the one hand, Professor Dawkins said it's very important that we should not demonize ordinary law-abiding, very decent Muslims, which, of course, is the vast majority in this country. But he says if you have these moderates, Christians or Muslims, here he's specifically speaking about Muslims, but if you have these moderates, that would give the false impression, quote, that there's something good about religion. And therefore, it would be worthy to bring up children with theological ideas, which then prepares the way for these extremists. Quote, they're entitled simply to say, oh, that's my faith. I believe it. You're not allowed to question it, and you're not allowed to ask me why I hold it. And he said, once you teach people that that's a legitimate reason for believing something, then you, as it were, give a license to the extremists who say, my belief is that I'm supposed to be a suicide bomber. I'm supposed to blow up buildings. It's my faith, and you can't question that. Oh, okay, so let me just make sure I have this right. I have a friend in India, Yesu Padam, and Yesu Padam is a man who was an untouchable, and he, at the age of 11, in hostility towards the system and hatred of the system, Yesu Padam became a Naxalite, a violent communist, and an atheist. So he rejected his father's Christianity. He rejected the Hinduism of his nation. He became an atheist. He became a violent man engaged in basically acts of terror against the rich. He became alcoholic atheist, and in his mid-20s had a vision of Jesus, was completely radically changed. He's now in his early 60s. He has built hospitals. He has orphanages, children's homes. They have taken many poor children, children with no possibility of meals, of education, of housing, and have raised them in the orphanages. Some of these kids now are doctors in America. Some of them are pastors in India. Some of them are nurses in India. So I just want to get this straight. So that now prepares the way for terrorism? Is that right? That prepares the way for terrorism? That by him turning from terrorist activities as an alcoholic, atheist, Maoist communist in India, that now opens the door for someone to be a suicide bomber? So by him turning from violence to compassionate help, they have homes for the elderly, they have training centers for handicapped to teach them a trade so that they can make a living and have self-respect in India. I've been there 21 straight years and seen the extraordinary work he's done. When he turned 60, government leaders came in from different parts of India to commend him for his work. So by doing that, that now gives place to religious beliefs, which leads someone to be a suicide bomber. Is that right? Or here, take a much more minor example, my own life, 16 years old, irreligious, raised in a Jewish home, but irreligious, shooting heroin, so despicable in my lifestyle, I stole money from my own father, violent, angry tongue, giving myself to all types of carnality. Hey, after all, you only got one life to live, just live it and enjoy it to the full, part of the counterculture revolution of the 60s that threw off a lot of religious tradition, religious sanctions and boundaries. And what happened? I got radically born again. My life radically, dramatically changed. Now I lead a ministry school, and we've sent workers out around the world. Some of them are helping the poorest of the poor. For example, our team in the Philippines, they fight human trafficking. They feed the poor. They care for orphans. They're strongly pro-life as well. They're helping with education. So that basically is now going to encourage someone to strap a vest on themselves and blow themselves up and be a suicide bomber. So with all respect to your great intellect and your scientific knowledge and your professorial career, no one downplays that or denies that. I must say, though, what you're saying is utterly irrational, utterly irrational. And simply the idea that there is no God and advocating that, you, sir, know the violence that's been done by atheists. You know the atrocities that have been committed by atheists. And the argument could be that if you raise someone saying there is no God and there is no judge and there is no one to whom you'll give account one day, that that leads to all types of atrocities and horrific crimes. And I am sure you could find far more violent people, people who were undermining social life, people who were guilty of destructive acts, who came to a living faith. I'll speak as a follower of Jesus, who came to a living faith in God through Jesus, who are no longer doing those things. Then you could find people who were irreligious and now became followers of Jesus, who are engaging in terrorist acts. Sir, your comments were utterly irrational and really show, more than anything, a hatred of the truth of God. I'm an academic person myself. I do not endorse irrationality. I do not endorse an anti-intellectual stand. I love God with all my heart and mind and soul and strength. And because of that, all the more, out of love for God and his love in my life, do I love my neighbor, not as a religious act, but from the heart. So please, sir, tell me, how a religion that teaches us its two highest priorities, love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself, how that opens the door to someone becoming a terrorist suicide bomber. Sir, your position is intellectually bankrupt, I'm sorry to say. All right. With that, we will now change subjects. 866-34-TRUTH. And I want to get to this. I want to get to this recent Barna survey, and I've seen it for a couple of weeks, and now finally getting around to addressing it on the air. Here's an article from Chris Woodward on OneNewsNow.com, Friday, August 1st. On Thursday, so this would have been the last day of July. George Barna, research expert and founder of the Barna Group, shared with American Family Radio's Today's Issues about new information he's compiling at American Culture and Faith Institute over the last 2 years, gauging where theologically conservative pastors are at politically. Quote, what we're finding is that when we ask them about all the key issues of the day, 90% of them are telling us, yes, the Bible speaks to every one of these issues. Then we ask them, well, are you teaching your people what the Bible says about those issues? And the numbers drop to less than 10% of pastors who say they will speak to it. May I repeat that, friends? I want to go back to my original thesis I stated at the beginning of the hour, that the reason that America's messed up is because the church is messed up. Remember, we're not 1.1% of the population or something like that. We're not, you know, 0.3% of the population. We're a substantial portion of the population. Those who claim to be evangelical Christians or born-again believers or Bible believers, we are a substantial portion of the population. Because of which, our failure brings failure in the nation. Our compromise brings compromise to the nation. Our lack of clarity brings confusion to the nation. So my fundamental thesis is that as we have failed, as the church has fallen short, it has messed up the nation. And the reason the church has messed up the nation is because the leaders have not done well. We, the leaders. So, hear this again. Barna Research. We're finding when we ask pastors about all the key issues of the day, 90% of them are telling us, yes, the Bible speaks to every one of these issues. Then we ask them, well, are you teaching your people what the Bible says about those issues? The numbers drop to less than 10% of pastors who say they will speak to it. Why? Why the lack of being willing to address the pressing cultural, moral, social issues of the day from the pulpit? If we don't do it, where is the clarity going to come from? We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I'm going to ask a generic question, all right? So I don't want people naming names, okay? I don't want you to talk about specific churches or denominations, but I am going to ask a generic question for your response. Why do you think many pastors are afraid to preach what the Bible says about controversial political issues? 866-34-TRUTH. Let me say that I'm here to serve and help pastors and leaders around America, around the world, and I've spent much of the last few decades doing that very thing. Whenever I'm able to serve fellow leaders, I do that because especially in our way of doing things where the whole load falls on the pastor and that people expect the pastor to do everything and be everything, especially in smaller churches, and the pastor is the counselor and the pastor is the preacher and the pastor is the teacher and the pastor is the conflict resolver and the pastor is the budgeter of finances and on and on. And let's be straight. The great majority of pastors and leaders are underpaid for the hours they put in. Let's be straight. The great, great, great majority of pastors and leaders are not doing this for the money. Let's just be totally candid about that. Yeah, there are people who do this for financial gain, but that is the real, real minority without question. And the ones that have the money pouring in that make these multi-million dollar salaries. I mean, what is that? One in a million leaders? I mean, it's phenomenally, ridiculously small number. All the people I know, all the people I've worked with seek to do right. All of us, I mean, you examine our lives, the people, the co-workers and things like that. The idea of being in it for money, it's the wrong business to be in for the money. That's the truth. So again, I'm not here to criticize. I'm here to help. I'm here to encourage. I'm here to strengthen. Big question, though. Why are politically controversial issues, but key issues? Issues our kids are dealing with. Come on, our kids are dealing with them in school. Even if they're in Christian school, they're dealing with them in social media. They're dealing with them with friends and peers. They're surrounded by these issues. Why are we often afraid to address them? Is it we don't want to mix politics with religion? According to Chris Woodward, OneNewsNow.com, this is Friday, August 1st, when researchers asked those pastors what else they are willing to do to get their people active in the political process, Barna said it's almost nothing. Quote, George Barna, "So the thing that struck me has been that when we talk about the separation of church and state, it's that churches have separated themselves from the activities of the state, and that's to the detriment of the state and its people." Woodward asked why to disconnect. According to Barna, the answer is simple. He suggests asking pastors how someone would know if their church is, quote, successful, which he did. Barna says there are five factors that the vast majority of pastors turn to and ask that question. Attendance, giving, number of programs, number of staff, and square footage. Oh, excuse me for that reaction. Come on, that's how you're going to define success of your church? Attendance, giving, number of programs, number of staff, square footage? You'd have a cult with a lot of people coming and giving a lot of money with all kinds of programs, big staff, and a giant building. Some of the biggest buildings you're going to run into are Mormon buildings. What does that prove? Some of the greatest devotion you're going to find is among Jehovah's Witnesses. What does that prove? There are mosques that are thriving. What does that prove? You want attendance? You want people spending a lot of money? You want a lot of activity, a lot of staff, square footage? Go to a football stadium or a baseball stadium or a basketball arena. Got a whole lot of that. What's that got to do with success? Oh, listen, I preach at mega churches that have multiplied thousands of people, and they have thousands of people because God's with them, because God's blessing them. But to use that as a measure, you've got to be kidding me. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Sid in Charlotte. All right. I was going to go to Sid. I don't think it was Sid Roth. I don't think it was Sid Roth calling the show. We'll have Sid on as a guest, my old friend Sid. Barnes says this. Now, all those things are good measures except for one tiny fact. Jesus didn't die for any of them. Barnes says, what I'm suggesting is those pastors probably won't get involved in politics because it's very controversial. Controversy keeps people from being in the seats. Controversy keeps people from giving money, from attending programs. As they look at things, their tendency is to say, well, that's not part of my mission. My mission is to bring in more people and get them to understand certain things that I feel they should know. Barn also thinks it has to do with something with the training of the pastors. Quote, when you look at what they get in Bible school or in the seminary, they are not taught to get people engaged in these particular issues. They are taught just to exegete scriptures. They're taught something about the history of where these scriptures came from, but they're not prepared. Hey, I believe that if you preach through the scriptures and you properly exegete the scriptures, you're going to end up getting involved in all kinds of controversies. You're going to get involved in all kinds of issues. They're going to come up. They will. Friends, it just so happens that our resource offer this week ties in absolutely directly with every word I'm talking about now. It's a teaching series. It's a class, a seven-hour mini class I did called It's Time to Rock the Boat. One of these things where with the Word of God and the truth of God and explosive quotes from history, man, we kind of take you and say, come on, let's stand up. Let's do it. One of these things that infuses courage in your heart. It's a $25 series on CD plus postage, but it's yours for your gift of any size. So if you want to help hold my hands up as a Jesus revolutionary, one that wants to see the gospel impact society, not with violence, not with hatred, not with intimidation, not with the human ugly means that people rely on, but with the life and power of the gospel. If you want to stand with us and help us, get this resource, your gift of any size. Some of you can sow large gifts into us, and you don't even think twice. And let me be totally straight with you. Not a dime of it will go in my pocket. Not a dime of it will go in my staff's pocket. It will go right out to reach more people through radio and through our other outreaches. So everyone that can, some of you have less, so those who have more can make up for that. Take advantage of this important resource. You can listen to it on your computer or download it for your MP3 player. It's Time to Rock the Boat. 7 hours, normally $25 plus postage, but yours for your gift of any size. Call 1-800-278-9978. 1-800-278-9978. Once more, that's 1-800-278-9978. Or if you want a special offer on a download, just the digital download, go to my website, AskDrBrown.org. All right, AskDrBrown.org. And when you go there, you'll see right on the homepage how you can download this at a special discount. Make sure you're on my website, click on latest video. We've got some very, very eye-opening videos that are getting a lot of attention that we have posted. And also check on latest article as well. Tonight, I've got an article coming out called Revolution is in My Blood.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to the line of fire, 866-34-TRUTH. We're talking about why pastors and leaders avoid preaching on politically controversial issues. According to a poll that was done on One News Now, I'll tell you what, I'll share the responses, that almost 3,000 responses. I'll share those with you later. I'm going to get your take first. 866-34-TRUTH. Again, my desire is not to bash. We're not going to do name calling. My desire is to try to be constructive and to help us do what is right. And I'm here to encourage. If there's courage in my heart, let it spread to your heart. Look, if I got on the air and I said, I don't know. I don't know. It's all coming down. It's looking bad. I mean, I think it's over. That wouldn't help you, would it? If I'm not your school teacher, but to use an analogy, if you had a school teacher and say there were a bunch of kindergarten students, you're not kindergarten students, I'm not the school teacher, but to use this analogy to make a point, if there was a fire alarm and the school teacher realized it was a real fire this time, and she said, oh, no, it's a fire. Oh, everybody follow me. Oh, no. Oh, no. Just follow me. The kids are going to start screaming and panicking and jumping out windows and hiding in closets. They'll do anything but follow, and the thing will be totally disorderly. And good chance they won't get out of the fire. If the school teacher said, okay, kids, fire alarm. Everybody follow me. Okay, right now, everybody. Okay, Johnny J, come on, follow me right now. Everybody would make it out just fine. So from the heart, I'm not discouraged. From the heart, I'm not fearful. From the heart, I speak the truth because it's the truth, because it's a sacred obligation, because it's a sacred duty, because it's my calling. But I know others have told me they won't touch certain issues. They're too hot. Why? It is hurting the nation. We are hurting the nation as leaders by not constructively addressing the tough social issues of our day. We'll go to Durham, North Carolina. Dwayne, welcome to the line of fire.
Hello, sir. How are you doing today?
Doing very well. Thank you.
Well, my comment is going to be short and sweet because I'm at work, but I think the main thing is that, one, the problem is separating church from state. I do know that churches are liable for repercussions. They speak out against state and political laws and stuff. I also feel that the problem is that people have the concept of it's okay as long as it's not hurting anybody else. Live your life as you want to. We've gotten away from the true meaning of the gospel that our Lord God in Christ Jesus came here to minister to us, and that is, yes, to love one another, but also to live holy and sanctified in our faith to Him, to call out what is evil, and to do our best to minister the gospel in all truth, even if we face persecution, because it's not death of this life that we should worry about, but the eternal death of the spirit and soul. People are more concerned to me, as I see in our society, United States, about financial gain instead of soul winning. A lot of churches have broken away from altar calling to win souls to Christ. They want to give people a quick fix and make them feel good. Now, there are preachers out there that do speak truth, and I hear a lot of them on the radio, and that's what I see to be a movement of the Spirit of the Lord doing His work, as it's been prophesied in the Bible in the last days.
Loud and clear. Yeah, loud and clear, Dwayne. I appreciate that. A lot of what we hear in America is a feel-good gospel and just kind of how to have a better life in this world and not really thinking about standing before God eternally and what really matters in His sight and how we are to live in this world. We start with it's about me. We're going to fail. We start with it's about Him. We'll be blessed. We'll be right back.
Fire we please, stand in the fire.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us on The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. The question asked in a OneNewsNow.com poll, what are the most likely reasons a pastor might refrain from preaching what the Bible says about controversial political issues? And this is the opinion of people. 9% said distaste for politics. 32% said threat of punishment by ACLU or IRS. So it's literally 31.86%. Wow. That's the opinion of people that responded to this. Unfamiliar with those issues, that's 7.5%. Told to do so by elders, deacons, that's 16%. Denominational constraints, 13%. Beliefs politics, church, are separate, that's 23%. What do you think? 866-34-TRUTH. And as a congregant, do you want your pastor to address these issues? Please hear me. The purpose of this radio show is not to take the place of your local church or home fellowship congregation, all right? That's not the purpose of this radio show. So I am not claiming that if I were a local pastor, that what I'd be preaching from the pulpit every Sunday would be the same material I'm covering over the course of 10 hours of radio broadcasts in a week. There are obviously different things that would be emphasized and certain grounding just in Bible foundations and spiritual life. But I'm fully aware that there are many fine pastors and teachers that are on the radio teaching these things, going through the scriptures, teaching doctrinal foundations, teaching spiritual life. And we touch on those things, but that's not primarily why I'm on the radio. I'm on the radio to be your voice, your listener-sponsored voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution, to be a voice of moral sanity and spiritual clarity in the midst of a society in chaos and a church all too often in compromise. So yes, that's why I'm on the air. And if I was pastoring a local church, then I would not be majoring on some of the things that I'm majoring on, but I would certainly be addressing them because they must be addressed. Now, you might say, I go to church to hear about Jesus. Ultimately, amen. In fact, I never like going through a worship service where his name and work are not exalted. In other words, just generic songs about God or spirituality or hunger for God, they have their place. But I want to hear Jesus exalted by name and by work as much as possible in the midst of services where we gather to worship. And I want to hear him exalted in preaching. Absolutely. But Jesus touched on all types of controversies. And if you're going to teach and preach what Jesus said and did, there's going to be controversy. And if you're going to go through the other parts of the Bible and preach holistically, you're going to hit on issues. What about sexual purity issues? What about pornography? What about divorce? What about adultery? What about teen pregnancy? Teen drug use? What about homosexual practice? What about social issues that are also of major concern? What about the attack of atheism? What about false religions? Should we have a position on Israel in the Middle East? I mean, these are all things that are going to come up if you live in this world. And for sure, and look, I'm not a gifted counselor. I've counseled people. I have biblical wisdom. Sometimes the Holy Spirit will give me insight, but I'm not a primarily gifted counselor. And yeah, I've had to counsel many people over the years and have to counsel people on the radio, but I do not pretend to be some gifted professional counselor. And if there's a real serious issue over the years, I'd always want Nancy to be present, not just a male-female thing, but I always want her present because she's got so much more wisdom in so many ways than I do. So I absolutely commend those who are counselors. And boy, my hat's off to you because I collapse under the weight of what you carry, not my calling, not my gifting, and I commend you. My question would be, if these things come up in your private counseling, doesn't it suggest then you should preach about them? If you're constantly dealing with couples in marital conflict, then shouldn't you be preaching and teaching about them? If they're coming to you and saying, what do I do? My kid just came out as gay. Shouldn't we be addressing these things? if you see the negative influence of the media on the people in your congregation, then shouldn't you be talking about that? I don't mean being savvy in what's happening. I'm not a moviegoer. I don't believe that the way to be relevant is to see all the latest movies and then use analogies for the movies for the congregation. The congregations I want to be part of, if I use analogies for the movies, they won't know what I'm talking about because they're not frequenting the movies because there's too much trash. And if it's a good godly movie, a God is not dead kind of thing, and, you know, great. Something godly or edifying or family fun, great. But so much of what's out there, vast majority, is unacceptable. So, you know, what's happened is pastors and leaders trying to be, quote, relevant, become utterly irrelevant in the process. Yeah, I feel strongly about this. Are you surprised? Is anyone listening that's listened to me more than a day, let alone for six straight years, or heard me teach or preach for decades? Is anyone in the least bit surprised that I have strong convictions about these things? Let's go to Clarissa in Glen Rose, Texas. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Hi. I just wanted to comment. I think a lot of the reason why worship leaders, pastors, rabbis are not commenting is because most of these issues are moral, and I think people still have a general hostility to being told what to do in the moral realm. They want to feel like they can decide in their own home what is good for them. So even if they're part of a congregation, part of a church, there still is a little bit of moral relativism that is going on, you know, personally behind the scenes. And ultimately, it just shows a hostility toward God that, you know, he can make decisions about some things, but when it comes to something like, you know, my child now is identifying with the LGBT lifestyle, well, you don't really know what that's like, so you can't make that decision for me.
Yeah, very, very true. It's moral relativism. Truth becomes relative as well. You have your truth. I have my truth. And it's affecting society on a very deep level. The one place where we should have an anchor for our soul is with God and his word. And many times there are leaders now in some of the church, especially what's called the emergent church movement, which is quite mixed, but in the negative part of it, what I see is what's called, what I call a celebration of ambiguity. Hey, I don't know. We don't, how can we know? And this whole idea that we can't be dogmatic, that we can't be clear, is somehow enviable. Whereas if we're going to lead, at least on foundational issues, we better have clarity. Clarissa, let me ask you personally. When you you have family, married with kids?
Yes.
Okay. So as a wife and mother and as a follower of Jesus, as you are hearing the gospel taught and preached in your church circles, do you feel that it's important that social and political issues are addressed, or is that just going to lead the pastors away from preaching and teaching the scriptures?
No, I think it should be addressed because part of, and I speak, I guess, from a little bit different standpoint because I'm a messianic believer, and so I after coming into that movement, I noticed a very big difference in the way that the message is given. And so we do want to reach into the community, and we do want to be part of, you know, politically what's going on. And what I noticed whenever I was, quote-unquote, in the church is that they want to pull out from the community, and they, you know, it's not as important to be effective. I think they say that they do, but I don't think they really know how to go about doing that because there's so many things morally bankrupt with our society, and those are the issues that the church really needs to be addressing front and center. So I think, you know, in my home, you know, when you use the word judge, and that word is so misused, you know, I have to judge every day what my kids are going to watch, who they're going to be friends with, who I'm going to allow to, you know, to be kind of in our inner circle. And so, you know, we are supposed to judge, and the Bible is supposed to be our standard in judging. That doesn't mean we're deciding somebody's eternal resting place or what their
we're not being judgmental, we're not being hypocritical, right, and superficial, but we are seeking to make judgments. Look,
absolutely,
when someone calls us judgmental, they're making a judgment. When someone
That's
says
right.
that we're bigoted because we don't endorse two men or two women, quote, marrying, they're making a values judgment. But Clarissa, I appreciate you weighing in with clarity of thought. And I encourage pastor leader friends, look, we're not experts on everything. And I understand my modern Hebrew is weak. My biblical Hebrew is strong. My spoken Hebrew is weak. And if I know that this Israeli wants to chat with me, I might avoid it because of the fact that I'm going to miss something that he or she says. So I understand when we don't have expertise, we can often shy away from something. But come on, the Word of God really does have the answer. And there are so many resources these days available. Let's speak the whole counsel of God as it addresses the whole counsel of life, or the whole of life. We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us on the Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. So in answer to the question, why pastors, leaders are afraid to preach what the Bible says about controversial political issues. Now, some are not afraid to. They simply say, hey, my job is to preach and teach the Word and not get involved with all these other subjects. My contention is when you preach and teach the Word, you will get involved with other subjects. Look, I'm not political in my mindset and orientation. Sometimes I listen to conservative radio driving in to my own show, and I'm hearing the same thing day in, day out, you know, bashing of Barack Obama and bashing of the Democratic Party and bashing of liberalism. And a lot of the criticism, I believe, is valid. And then other things I wouldn't agree with. But that's not me. That's not me. And if I listen to liberal talk radio, I'd hear every day bashing Republicans and bashing conservative. And if there's a Republican president, bashing a Republican president. And sometimes the criticism would be fair, but that's not me. I talk about the issues I talk about because they're kingdom issues. I talk about the issues that I do on this radio broadcast because they're biblically related issues. And that's why we address them. And we're flooded with people appreciating us doing it. Yeah, flooded with people who hate us too, but far more express their appreciation and the need for what we're doing. Here are some of the responses to this question I posted on Facebook. Why do you think pastors are afraid to preach what the Bible says about controversial political issues? A fear of man, fear of loss, fear of personal cost, fear of persecution, fear of an exodus. Let's see. We have an excellent pastor who speaks truth in love. Glad to see that. Let's see. Fear. Too many think they need mega churches. They're following after man, not after God, and just plain fear. They fear losing their 501c3 more than they fear God. Multiple money signs. Way too many reasons why than what Facebook allow, but none of the reasons are acceptable because they fear and honor man more than God. Yes, I think the American church has created a culture of boys and not men. We focus on obeying rules instead of purpose. I've long thought that if military service was required of pastors, we'd have a far better church. That's an interesting thought. The Muslims will riot in the street and start a world war. For the record, dead men have no fear. Oh, if you die to opinions of people, all right, then you wouldn't fear. Money, which is one reason that mega churches get rich. Now listen. In point of fact, there are many fine men and women preaching the gospel, speaking the truth, who are not afraid. But I hear from leaders who say other leaders will not address issues. Why? Can I tell you the attack that comes my way since I've addressed certain controversial issues? Here, I'll give you just a little sampling. And look, you're a pastor. You don't want your church associated with controversy. You don't want to be hated. All right. You don't want to be rejected and mocked. Of course not. Oh, let's just see here. Let me find a few of these. Oh, okay. Here we go. No, that's not strong enough. Let me find a few of these. They're just, I mean, scores and scores and scores and scores and scores. I find Dr. Brown offensive to anyone who doesn't share his oh-so-holy views. I give less than one star in a review on Facebook, but I'm unable to. Teaches people to be against one another instead of togetherness. Just blows on the embers of hatred and bias. Teaches people to judge instead of tolerance. Mindless tripe. Dr. Brown, no, that's your God-fearing person. Don't spread blasphemy because I stand with Israel. Very bad terrorist site. This is my Facebook page is a very bad terrorist site. Being pro-Israel, the theology is a crime against scripture. Oh, let's just see here. The man is a bigot, not representative of Christ. Profanity. I don't know who you are, but one thing, you're an Islam hater. Hate mongering bigotry. Homophobic, bigoted, and basically a worse word for a prostitute. You're not a doctor because doctors save lives, and you're diminishing human lives to numbers and statistics because I stand with Israel. Dr. Brown, it doesn't really surprise me how biased you are, and if you're a doctor, I must be Superman. Replace the word doctor with Zionist so things are clearer. This just posted on Facebook, F Israel, I stand with Gaza. Dr. Brown, you don't get it when it comes to discrimination. You simply have not done your research, Dr. Brown. More profanity. Completely irrational claptrap from an ill-informed buffoon, and on and on. That's just stuff that comes our way on a daily basis. Some pastors and churches say, I don't want that. I don't want to deal with that. I don't want protests in front of my church building. I don't want nasty signs in front. I want someone to vandalize the building. I want our people to come and feel safe and secure. Well, I absolutely agree that you don't want to provoke hatred and controversy. But how safe and secure was it to follow Jesus and be an apostle, say, in the first 30 years after his death? How safe was it? How safe was it to be a follower of Jesus in the first 100 years? How safe was it? Is it today to be a follower of Jesus in the Muslim world? Our goal cannot just be safety. Our goal must be speaking the truth in love. That's what it must be. And if we do not do that, then we are dishonoring the Lord and hurting other people. I just noticed this post a moment ago from someone in our area that I do plan to get together with, a lesbian woman with her partner. Hi, Dr. Brown. Just want to let you know that this nastiness is what you're inspiring in your followers. Quote, look, homo perverts, if I wanted to associate with perverts like yourself, I won't be listening to Christian talk radio, but a pervert show like yourselves, just like Lot and Sodom, I don't need to get paid attention to perverts. So goodbye and get lost. Do you endorse this kind of behavior? Do you endorse this kind of grammar? Maybe you're listening right now and you posted this. God forbid. See, anyone listening to this show and hearing me is going to have the opposite attitude. And I perpetually hear from people who are now walking in love and compassion to homosexual friends and neighbors because they've read my books and listened to the show. I'd have to ask you if you endorse the day and night hate mail that comes to me from those who identify as gay and lesbian. Of course you wouldn't. That's what happens when people are irrational and don't listen. Friends, I want to urge you, pastors, leaders, speak the truth, regardless of cost or consequence. My series this week, 7-hour series, $25 plus postage, but yours for your gift of any size on CD to listen to on your computer MP3 player. It's Time to Rock the Boat. It's a class I taught that will energize you to stand for the truth. Call 1-800-278-9978, 1-800-278-9978. My bottom line today, do you fear God? Do you fear man? Are you trying to do what's right in the sight of God, or just keep people happy?